our next speaker is Dr. Nicholas DiLorenzo. He'll bring in the animal integrated system. He'll be speaking about cover crops and livestock integration.
Thank you, Dr. Rowland. None of my lab members are here, otherwise I would challenge Dr. Lundgren on the best lab ever, so he can back me up. Thanks. First of all, I want to thank the committee for the invitation to be part of this. I want to acknowledge my collaborators here. Truly, my work is multidisciplinary by nature. We have plant pathologists, we have agronomists, microbiologists, biochemists, and row crop experts in this. So it's truly a multidisciplinary approach that we take to this. So one of the advantages of my workplace is that I really work across from a plant breeder. I have maybe down the hall a forage management expert, animal scientist. So a lot of the stuff that I do really has this multidisciplinary approach. And when I was challenged with the task of talking here about ecosystem services, and in fact, the integration between crops and livestock, first I have to look up some definitions, and I didn't know much about ecosystem services. We're starting to work in that area, but it's not an area that I actively work. So the first thing is to look at a definition, and this is pretty straightforward: conditions and processes through which natural ecosystems and the species that make them up sustain life and fulfill human life. That seems pretty easy, right? However, when I start looking at the web of different ecosystem services, I've started putting pieces together. So what is really what we are looking for in ecosystem services? And as you can see here, we have a portion that is supporting, and I will briefly talk about the nutrient cycling, soil formation, water provision, genetic biodiversity. Provisioning, that's the one topic where I will concentrate the most. I must say, I fail to say that I'm an animal scientist by nature, but I actually, by training, I'm an agronomist, and I've been working for 14 years in animal science, so it's a great opportunity for me to bring together some of my early knowledge and systems and try to apply it, in this case, more about provisioning, what I'll talk today. But there's a few things that I would like to address on the regulation or regulating ecosystem services. I tried to put together a look at some presentations. I realized that one of the things missing was some of this part, the soil retention and pollination. So I was very pleased to see some earlier presentations today addressing that. I think there is a lot more to come, and I will come back to that, a lot more to do, and I will come back to that at the end of my presentation. And of course, there's the cultural ecosystem services, recreational, and spiritual. All that contributes to the human well-being. When I started putting together this presentation, I came across some issues that cover crops. I started to look for definitions of cover crop. And I took a poll within my co-authors in this, and I went and asked, some of them are here, so I won't share what they say. But basically, I started realizing that there is a diversity in terms of what we consider a cover crop. Some people would say that may not be grazed, and I'll quote some of the things I found in papers. Planted to improve soil quality, prevent erosion, I don't think we can argue about that, or weed suppression. And many of the publications I've found this not for harvest. And then I stopped and I almost rethought my whole, I thought I was going to have to find another symposium to speak at because I would not fit longer in the cover crop livestock integration if I cannot graze it. How about hay, I wonder. And luckily I keep searching, came across this NDSU papers, and it's actually an extension report. But and then I found many other reports, but basically they acknowledge the fact that the cover crops can be grazed, and in fact there are some benefits that hopefully I'd like to convey to you through this presentation about grazing cover crops. And some of that it's actually tied to some of the issues that we heard before about food security and the fact that we have to feed a growing planet, so we have to take advantage of some of these resources. If we consider that only 5% of the, just picture the energy from the solar biomass, photosynthesis can capture that. We can only use 5% for human food, and that would be corn, any of the vegetables that we can eat. The rest has to somehow go through a system. This is, of course, my favorite system to to convert grass into some of these nutrition products. And this system is possible mainly because of the gastrointestinal tract. This is a ruminant, as you may not know, cattle ruminants have a unique characteristic, that is, they harbor microorganisms in the lower and in their gastrointestinal tract, such as protozoa, bacteria, and fungi, that they can digest or ferment this fibrous stuff, cellulose, the most abundant carbohydrate on earth. They can transform that into highly nutritious products. So there is an opportunity there to integrate already cover crops with this systems, and that's what I would like to cover a little bit. This is North Florida Research and Education Center, the research center where I work at. And this is a very common picture. This is actually from a few years ago, a study we did. I want to point out to what it looks like without the cover crop versus, in this case, triticale and ryegrass. And I have to do a disclaimer here. Most of my talk today, when I talk about cover crops, I'll be talking about ryegrass, triticale, rye, some sort of winter forage. So keep that in mind. What are some of the obvious benefits of that? So when we talk about what can we do to improve the production, if we look at this, this is a study I did a few years back. We have a supplemented control, rye and ryegrass. And I have to point out that the rye and ryegrass and triticale are some of our common forage systems we use as a winter cover crop, but there's others too. And I will address some of the research from one of my colleagues here that we look at some other forages. Never mind the production here, the point or the level that you see, and the point is that we can get up to 700 grams per day of beef in the system, and that's not minor, okay? Oops. This is some data from José Dubé, one of my collaborators, and if you look at this, in this picture here, we have different grazing opportunities or different grazing times, all the way from December to March. And what you see here, a little different from what I presented before, a little better gains. We have gains of up to almost a kilogram per day in this system of cattle. So beef cattle gaining 1 kilogram per day when grazing either oats and ryegrass, ryegrass, or triticale. I must point out that this systems here, or this study by Dr. Dubé, was done using what we call a variable stocking rate. In other words, the stocking rate was adjusted so that we always have an herbage allowance somewhat constant. And we have to do those kind of studies when we want to compare the different systems, when we're looking at a systems approach. In my previous study that I show, I didn't do that because mainly I had a supplementation treatment that I have to have a fixed stocking rate. Those are some of the difference that you see in gain. We are closer to 1 kilogram of gain in beef versus the 710 grams that I had before. If you put this in terms of gain per hectare, we're looking at anywhere from 340 or from 320 to 340 kilograms of beef produced per hectare, and that is huge. Okay, that's something that we cannot miss in the context of integrating crops and livestock. We cannot miss that opportunity to produce that much beef per hectare. And this, again, are winter grazing systems in North Florida, and this is part of what I call the obvious portions of ecosystem services. That's the provisioning. So provisioning, no surprise that that's what we find. Now, I like to talk about something that is not as obvious, nutrient cycling. Perhaps an excellent article that I find by researchers in North Carolina, France, and Brazil talk about an antidote for intensification of loss of diversity, perhaps, with winter or actually livestock crop integrations. I will come back to nutrient cycling in a little bit. But for now, I wanted to start a discussion of the stocking rates and how that affects this ecosystem. So we have, inherently, we have systems that are producing biomass with a somewhat fixed stoichiometry between carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus. If the biomass is undisturbed, the amount of carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus follows a similar ratio, and to some extent it's been debated that carbon fluxes are the ones that determine phosphorus and nitrogen. In other words, carbon fluxes can dictate what phosphorus and nitrogen fluxes will be. And the different resident time of this carbon in the systems will have implications in terms of the carbon trade between the different pools. But one interesting fact is the coupling between carbon and nitrogen that takes place that avoids the accumulation of nitrates, for instance, what we call reactive nitrogen, and also prevents denitrification and loss in the form of nitrous oxide, which has different consequences also, or more importantly, in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And when we have a high stocking rate or any intensification of the system, we run into the issue of a decoupling, and I will talk about this decoupling many times or a couple times. And that is a problem, and we'll come back to that. I want to highlight briefly our salt-based rotation, which is a project from the University of Florida that has been going on for years, even before I joined the University of Florida. I was fortunate to join that group, and we did some work with some funding from the USDA. Basically, it's a system that involves doing something that we know we've done for years, but that is rotating crops with pasture, and farmers will acknowledge that some of their best yields comes after in lots that have been after pasture. So in this system, we have 2 years of bahia grass followed by peanut and cotton in a rotation. This is about 16 hectares each of these quadrants. And we have three sampling sites, three exclusion cages that we can use for sample. The exclusion cages prevent cattle from going in. So we have that comparison. We have areas where cattle have never been in. And we have areas where they're grazed by cattle, especially on the winter. We do winter cover crops and in the second year bahia grass. This is a little bit of what it looks like. This is a place where the exclusion cage was. And I want to now highlight some work by Dr. Shisha George. He presented this a few years ago, and it's out of this salt-based rotation program. It's some very interesting work on cycling. I'm because of constraints of time, I only have a few slides to show, but we have a lot more, and I encourage you, if you're interested, to look up some of the other work. What she did is she looked at the activity of enzymes that are related to the cycling of nitrogen, phosphorus, and carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur. So we have this grazed and irrigated, because remember we have an irrigated and non-irrigated sampling site. So we have grazed, irrigated, non-grazed, irrigated, grazed, and non-irrigated, and then non-grazed, non-irrigated. So these columns follow the same pattern. And what we look is at enzyme activity is characterized by paranitrophenol per kilogram of salt per hour. And what we have here is several enzymes, alkaline phosphatase, acid phosphatase, aryl sulfatase, beta-glucosidase, and beta-glucosaminidase. And they're all enzymes related to the cycling of these nutrients. And the main observation out of this is that if you see across the different enzymes, always when cattle are present, we have a greater activity, enzymatic activity of this key enzyme. So the point is that we are cycling more nutrients when cattle are present. That's something that's already a benefit, and it's hard evidence of a benefit towards that ecosystem service. However, this is coming back to that slide when I show you in orange that we might have some issues at higher stocking rates. And I would say higher stocking rates or any kind of intensification, improving the digestibility of the crop. So we have 70% of the carbon that is consumed will be released in the atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide through the respiration or by enteric fermentation as methane. Whereas on the other hand, 70 to 80% of the nitrogen will return to the pasture as urine or dung. And that already you can see how is a decoupling in this system, and the more intensified it gets, the more we decouple that carbon from nitrogen, and harder it is for that system to capture those reactive nitrogen species, and for instance, nitrate, and it's a lot less resilient to leaching, for instance, of nitrate to underground water. So that's one of the issues at higher stocking rates that we see, and that begs the question of whether systems are a carbon sink or net emitters. There's an excellent work published in the journal Animal by Susanna et al. In 2010, where they examined different scenarios, and I'm not going to have time to go through all the scenarios, but basically these are the different fluxes of carbon, manure, respiration, enteric methane emissions, etc. And one conclusion out of that, and it's supported by others too, is that the stocking rate and the management are key factors in determining the point of equilibrium. And when I'm talking about point of equilibrium here, it's basically talking about whether a system is a net emitter or a sink of carbon. And to further, to make it even more complicated, systems that, animal systems that rely on high forages or high fiber stuff, we have more methane produced, which contributes to sort of a negative balance in the greenhouse gas cap or emissions of that system. This is some work out of my lab that we published earlier this year, where we have cattle, and I'll show you some pictures of how we measure this. But basically, a high concentrate versus a high forage diet, or this is a low concentrate, basically had a lot more roughage in the diet. We have close to three times more methane emitted in cattle, and that's what this was done in vivo. So this doesn't help the site of the grazing. This is how we measure. This is one of the studies by Marta Coman doing her master's. We have to feed animals with this device. This is called the sulfur hexafluoride tracer technique. And by this technique, we're able to measure methane in vivo in cattle, and we can, for five continuous days, we collect these canisters that are taking a sample out of the nostrils, and we analyze by gas chromatography. And that way, we can tell, we can measure how much methane is being produced. That is that study. So basically, we have paddocks in which we have to put tester animals that wear this device. That through this device we're able to collect methane continuously, and we analyze it to get a total estimate in grams per day. Calculating or measuring intake continues to be, I would argue, the greatest challenge in grazing livestock research. We are fortunate we have a system in North Florida called the GrowSafe. It's a bank equipped with load cells where we can measure intake on an animal's in a way that is very, I would argue that it doesn't mimic perhaps grazing behavior, but this is one way we can at least measure intake on high forage systems. This is a study we repeated over 2 years, cutting those winter forages and offering them fresh every day, actually cutting even twice a day, to cattle. That way we can track intake on this. At least we have an idea of the gut fill effect of this really high moisture forages, and have an idea how much they might be consuming on the pasture. This is a lot easier to do on a winter cover crop that is somewhat homogeneous compared to our normal warm season forages. So with that, and just to conclude and summarize, the grazing of cover crops, and in this case, I pretty much circumscribe my research or my talk to winter annuals. There's a lot of other cover crops, but in North Florida, it's a very efficient system. We can effectively increase certain ecosystem services. Nutrient cycling and provisioning are, like I say, some of the obvious ones. The net greenhouse gas emissions in a system, and I emphasize the system approach because it's completely different on an animal base, are greatly dependent on many factors, of which stocking rate, in other words, the intensity of management of that system, it's a determinant. Or whether that system is a net sink or net emitter. If it's undisturbed, grasslands typically are considered net carbon sink. Same with forestry systems. They are considered a net sink, carbon sink. However, we saw that may not be the case with intensive management land. If we look at the activity of enzymes, nutrient cycle, we have evidence that grazing will enhance some of those nutrient cycling related enzymes, so that's beneficial from the standpoint of the ecosystem services. And just to finish, I want to know or address some of the challenges and perhaps some opportunities for research that we might see. To me, one of the greatest challenges in ecosystem services, and I'm by no means expert in ecosystem services, but I've just started to become more aware of this, is that the one that I talk about today, provision, seems quite obvious. 340 kilograms of beef produced per hectare. I can put economic terms to that. I think producers really realize of this. It's no secret. But how about some of the other stuff? Nutrient cycling, we have some evidence of that. How about pollination? And I was, like I say earlier, pleased to see in this symposium some talks about that. So I think there are some research efforts that are already taking place. Actually, quantifying greenhouse gas emissions at a system level continues to be a challenge. I didn't have enough time to expand on how challenging it is to measure methane with the SF6 technique. I have some colleagues here that are trying to use the same technique, and I know they would attest that it's a challenge. We have to address the carbon and nitrogen uncoupling in some of those systems, especially, as I say, when we intensify the management. But perhaps the greater, and this is something that I took from our keynote address, Dr. Ramaswamy, he talked about the greater uncoupling, the rural versus urban. So I wanted to go back to this, because in many of the papers that I found, they addressed this issue of ecosystem services and how challenging it is for us to convey or to try to reconcile these two aspects, perhaps the recreational system, ecosystem services versus the provisional, and how important it is to make people aware, especially people that are not involved in this type of research, of the importance of this systems beyond the provisioning. So I think that's one of the greatest challenges, and I thought it was a great keynote address talking about that, because that's, to me, the greatest challenge we might find in the future for the systems. And there are some opportunities that exist. Salt-based rotation, I just highlighted, that's one of the projects we have in North Florida that we were able to increase organic matter to a certain point. The challenge happens to take that organic matter to the next level. That's proved to be a little bit more challenging. But we can increase nutrient cycling and many other things, so perhaps we need to concentrate more in salt-based systems. And also the inclusion of legumes, with a legume reducing the dependence on nitrogen fertilizer, perhaps addressing a little bit that uncoupling and try to prevent the leaching of nitrate to underground water. There is some potential of reducing methane from cattle with legumes, and that is through some legumes that have tannins, and I was really pleased to see that there is a symposium this afternoon about that. I think it's a very interesting approach. So with that, I want to thank you for your attention. I'll turn it over to Dr. Rowland. Good question. Nitrogen application rate and our winter system. We've done, at least in the one that I did earlier, we did 50 kilograms of nitrogen per, and two, actually 150 in each one of two applications split. I'm not sure, Jose, in the one you did about the same? Yeah. So in the one of Dr. Dubay, we did, and that was a two-year study. We pretty much do close to 100. We actually add about 10 to 12 kilograms of sulfur also, but we do not add any phosphorus on those systems.
So the heavy loading of nitrogen
for just a couple grass-based pastures, that plays into your nitrogen coupling equipment as well, which greatly reduces the nitrogen. Definitely. And we, I mean, I didn't have a time to go into that. One of our biggest struggles is legume for the summer. We have some legumes, and Dr. Dubay is doing a lot of research on that, that fit really well into our winter forage systems, crimson clover, bald clover, persimmon, but we have not been able to find a good warm season legume that will help us in the summertime.
We'll talk about that later.
Good, look forward to it.
Thank you.
Thank you.